This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When T.S. Eliot wrote, "April is the cruelest month," he wasn't thinking of tax day, although you might be. Ever since the Academy of American Poets initiated National Poetry Month 15 years ago, April has become the coolest month. Gibbons Ruark has been writing poetry every month for more than 45 years. He grew up the son of a Methodist minister, moving from town to town in eastern North Carolina. Went to school at UNC Chapel Hill, taught briefly at UNCG, before settling into a long career at the University of Delaware. But North Carolina was never far from his mind or his poetry. Gibbons came home to the Tar Heel State when he retired. He lives and writes in Raleigh now, and he joins me today to help celebrate National Poetry Month. Gibbons Ruark, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Frank. Glad to be here.
You came along at an interesting time in the world of American poetry. Maybe it's best to understand this if we talk about two anthologies that came out almost at the same time. First called The New Poets of England and America. That was out in 1957. Mm-hmm. And then the second called The New American Poetry, published in 1960. Tell us about those two books.
Well, at least in those days, they were known as Anthology A and Anthology B. And Anthology A was The New Poets of England and America, edited by Donald Hall and others, and Anthology B was The New American Poetry, I think edited by Donald Allen, and it contained largely beat poets, poets associated with the Black Mountain School, and oddly enough, the Anthology A, I think people regarded as a more academic anthology. The fact that English poets were included put it more in the tradition of poetry other than American poetry. There was one poet common to both anthologies, a woman named Denise Levertov, and it was quite striking that there was only one who managed to cross that particular divide. I think things are a lot more diverse these days than they were then, but...
And that first, that the older one being more formal. I mean, you could look at the two books and see that there was something different.
Shapes of the poems on the pages. Certainly, the shapes were more uniform in the Anthology A, and those people in the Anthology A were the people I went to school to, in effect, in my own studies and my own work.
Is that where you'd put your work, Anthology
A?
I'd
put it in Anthology A rather than Anthology B, but I'd rather have it uncategorized except poem by poem, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I could ask you to read one of those poems, we'll put it in a category.
Okay.
We'll do it for you, although not on the show. Will you read one for us?
Sure. I might start with a somewhat dark poem, although it is a love poem. It's called Lament, and it has a little epigraph from the great Greek actress Melina Mercouri, who, when asked by a talk show host whether she regretted anything in her past, she said no. What I regret is many things in my future. So this poem is a kind of catalog of the things I regret in my own future. Lament. One sore thing is the way our only friends will die, with nothing more to say than a long goodbye or no goodbye at all. Another thing's the work shutting down to a small eye batting in the dark. Then come the gay daughters, gone from their wedding clothes. Where you heard their laughter, hang a drained garden hose. Right down dry veins, the hug of pain in every kiss. Soon any catalog of woe must come to this. My body breaking down beside your body, till one of us is gone, and the sheets are bloody, and I am your lover, taken by the darkness, or a blank light forever where your lovely head was.
Gibbons Ruark reading the poem Lament, a dark poem and a love poem.
Yes, I would think so. Theodore Retke, the poet, used to say that the poet's two duties are to lament and to praise. And I would modify that and say that the poet's one duty is to lament and to praise.
All in one. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's the certainly the beauty of this poem and many of your others, the this mingling, you know, the marriage of heaven and hell, if you will, in these poems, where the darkness breaks through in a way. Does it do this for, into a kind of a light, into a kind of a new understanding of these issues that we all grapple with and often suppress? But now you expose them. You expose them through language. We're going to deal with our lament. We're going to think about that long goodbye and how hard that is. Does it come to you at once, this kind of dark and light, lament and praise all at once, or is it sequential as you're working through the poem?
No, I think it comes somehow all at once at the same time. Maybe the darkness dominates at one point and the light dominates at another. But I think that I used to try to say that there were only two kinds of poems, love poems and elegies. And then when the people you love die, your love poems turn into elegies. Mm-hmm. So there's really only one kind. But that's partly facetious anyway, but it comes close to my feeling about it.
Well, and I ask you that, and I appreciate the answer, because this whole crazy project of ours of trying to communicate ideas in our head that are images mostly, particularly when they're ambiguous and they often have conflicting images, I still wonder how that forms in the mind of a poet. And if it starts as a picture, as images to you, and then you say, oh, you know what, but the only tool I have here really is words.
Well, I think it sometimes starts as images and sometimes also starts as sounds. I mean, I just hear a rhythm or a phrase or catch something that somebody said somewhere. I almost never have anything that could legitimately be called an idea for a poem. I know that T.S. Eliot said that Henry James had a mind so fine that no idea could violate it. I don't think I have that kind of mind, but I do run shy of ideas for poems. Not that my poems don't advance themselves in the direction of ideas eventually, but they begin with sounds, images, occasions, fragments of speech. I probably would never have written the lament poem if it hadn't been for what Melina McCoury said.
So that epigraph then really did trigger the poem.
It did key the poem, and then the poem is just simply a catalog of those things which I anticipate regretting.
Will you read another one for us?
Yes, I'll read another little love poem. This one involves, since it's National Poetry Month, well, actually it should be World Poetry Month to include this one, because this makes a reference here to an English poet named Edward Thomas, who was killed at 39 in World War I, just 3 years after he had started to write poetry at the encouragement of Robert Frost, whom he was living near for a while in England. Frost was in England and actually made his reputation in England in the couple of years before World War I began. There's a reference in this poem to a little town called Steep, which is actually the name of a town, but it also describes the landscape that the poem comes out of. And it's a love poem and an elegy combined, and it's called Words to Accompany a Wildflower from Edward Thomas's Hillside. Listen close and delicate. This wildflower is the late wayside violet that shines nearly hidden in the dense foliage where the hills of Steep gave the poet pause to breathe on his way to where the war changed his name into a scar, knocked his fine heart from his chest, blanked the eyes that Helen kissed. This wild blossom still has 5 leaves of starlight, tentative, dried in darkness for a year since I found it in the far hillside path where Edward climbed, holding Helen in his mind. Now the nameless stars are out. Now the name of Thomas floats like a star among the scars. Here's his violet for years.
Gibbons Ruark reading his poem, Words to Accompany a Wildflower from Edward Thomas's Hillside. Was it his work that inspired you, or just the notion that someone was lost at so early in his career?
A combination of both. His work is lovely. He's too little known, but Frost regarded him as a very fine poet in his prose, and encouraged him to write verse. And Frost said about him that he was the closest thing to a brother that he had ever had. And I would have to put him very high among my favorites, among the poets.
One of the things I love about this poem is the way that the language and the form itself work together to communicate all of the emotion and the, you should pardon the expression, ideas that come through in this poem. Tell us about that. Again, this if we're going back to our initial conversation about Book A and Book B, the more formal poetry of the early part of the 20th century, and then the more open verse in the Beat Generation. How do the lines, maybe you can give us a quick tutorial, a kind of 101, if you don't mind, about how the lines, the length of the lines work and these couplets work together.
Well, this is actually the meter in this poem. To go in the direction of your tutorial, the meter in this poem is an odd meter, but it was used by poets through the years. I'm not quite sure what it's even called, but the line starts with an accented syllable and ends with an accented syllable. And I don't know if you know W.H. Auden's famous poem called Lullaby, but it begins, "Lay your sleeping head, my love, human on my faithless arm. Time and fevers burn away individual beauty from thoughtful children," and so on. And that's the meter that I'm using in this poem. And I like it for its both its swiftness and its strength. And I'm also half-rhyming throughout the poem. Delicate, late, shines, dense. These are all off-rhymes. So the poem is both formal and informal. And it also has to do with couples. My wife and I and Edward Thomas and his wife, Helen, Helen named, fortunately, with a famous name.
Right. So that, closely associated with the fortunes of war.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and with Yeats's thinking of Maud Gunn in association with Helen of Troy. Mm. So
you get these associations. The form is a part of what you're trying to communicate. And of course, you're in the business of meter and rhythm. You're thinking about these things all the time. You're listening for them. Have you ever begun a poem and it's in a rhythm and that's what you heard? That was the sound that launched the poem, and you realize it's just all wrong. The content and the meter are just all off. They're not married.
If I've begun one like that, usually I've not finished it. Mm-hmm. I've sensed it fairly early on, but I work a long time on poems and revise over a long period of time, and usually some French poet said poems are never finished, they're only abandoned in despair. And so even the ones I've kept are abandoned in despair. But
Do you go back over the old poems and say, "Oh, I should have done this," or you just leave?
No, I'm not much of a. I think somebody like Yeats is famous for that. He was always trying to make his older poems sound like his more recent poems. He was a great revisionist, but I tend to leave things pretty much alone once I'm finished with them. Although it takes me, as I say, a very long time to finish a poem, and I'm an occasional poet in at least two senses of the word. I write about occasions, and I write occasionally.
That's so perfect. And it's very poetic, I might add. Will you read another one for us?
Well, yes. I'll read a poem that is actually set in Ireland, which is a place that I'm devoted to. And where I've traveled off and on over the years. But this poem, even though it's set in Ireland, is really a poem that looks in the direction of North Carolina. It's set in a small fishing village in County Galway on the coast of Galway Bay, a little place called Kinvara, but it looks toward my North Carolina childhood. It's called Transatlantic Summer Elegy. Dusk in Kinvara, an old man quietly sings to the air. In a distant time zone, late summer is leaving town. From houses with small children, the yellow porch lights flick on after supper, hazy constellations of dim, low stars. High stars are still, the air so still, the odor of honeysuckle sleeps in the hedges. This is a night to keep still in the branches till someone on a porch starts calling you home. Each house circled by light is holding its breath when suddenly out of nowhere a breeze rises and the whole of the great night tree starts swaying, as if it were not all the leaves, but one. The wrong old man keeps singing in Kinvara.
Gibbons Ruark reading his poem, Transatlantic Summer Elegy. In that poem, what struck me was the skillful way in which my senses were engaged in series. I saw light, I felt things against my skin, then I heard. And I might add, if I may, notice the skillful use of the word still, things quiet down. Is that something that you intend, a kind of serial sensory experience, or did it come out? Did you have to rearrange to make that happen? Or am I just seeing faces in the clouds?
Well, I think once somebody said, maybe it was Randall Jarrell said, writing a poem is a way of forgetting how you wrote it. But I'm always trying for the sensual detail and want my poems open to all five senses. But I think sometimes you're conscious of one and doing the other at the same time unconsciously. So
you're still writing?
Yes.
Some. You're back home now. Home for 15 years, is that or so. Does it feel like coming back now, or does it feel like, you know, you've never left, having been back for 10, 15 years?
Well, I've been back only about 6 years, actually. I was gone almost 40 years, so although I was back intermittently. But I live in Raleigh, where I have relatives and friends, and though I've never lived there before, and I love it. And I love North Carolina and being back.
We love that you're here. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Gibbons Ruark, the author of 8 books of poetry, including Passing Through Customs and Staying Blue. Coming up after a short break, Mount Moriah plays live. Stay with us on The State of Things.